The Supreme Court decision overturning the Texas sodomy law had critics complaining that the country was on a slippery slope that would lead to the legalization of everything from prostitution to adultery. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been tracking the expression slippery slope and the rhetorical work it does.
I read last week that Democrats were complaining that the administration's prescription drug bill puts the nation on the slippery slope toward Medicare privatization, that the dismantling of West Bank outposts puts Israel on a slippery slope leading to its destruction, and that the ownership of a women's NBA team by a Connecticut casino sets the sport on a slippery slope toward control by gamblers. And not surprisingly, the metaphor was ubiquitous in condemnations of the Supreme Court's overturning of the Texas sodomy law. Jerry Falwell said that it set the nation down a slippery slope in which courts might approve bestiality, prostitution, and the use of narcotics. To judge from the news stories, the entire nation is coming to resemble San Francisco after a heavy rain. In the press, the phrase slippery slope is more than five times as common as it was 20 years ago. It's a way of warning of the dire effects of some course of action without actually having to criticize the action itself. No wonder it's a favorite ploy of hypocrites. Not that there's anything wrong with A, mind you, but A will lead to B and then C, and before you know it, we'll be up to our armpits in Z. That argument goes by various names. The phrase slippery slope dates from the mid-19th century, around the same time that people started to talk about letting the camel's nose into the tent. That's an allusion to a fable about a camel who asks if he can put his nose into a workman's tent to keep it from the cold, and goes on to insert his shoulders, then his legs, and so on, until he dispossesses the inhabitant. Then there's the domino effect, an analogy that Dwight Eisenhower used in 1954 to justify U.S. intervention in Vietnam. Or people talk about the thin end of the wedge, the snowball effect, the doomsday scenario, or opening the floodgates. One way or another, it always comes down to God knows where it will end. The rhetoric textbooks usually describe the slippery slope as a logical fallacy, but sometimes it can be a reasonable form of argument. When you say that A puts us on a slippery slope to B, you might mean only that A will make it cheaper or easier to implement B. The UCLA law professor Eugene Volokh gives the example of installing video cameras at every intersection. That may make it easier to deter street crime, but it also provides the government with a means to perform more sinister forms of surveillance. Or sometimes the slippery slope is invoked in the course of an argument about the impossibility of making clear moral distinctions. If it's hard to draw the line between A and B, then how can you accept one and reject the other? That's an argument you're always hearing from abortion critics. Where does a fetus end and a child begin? It's an instance of what Greek philosophers called the fallacy of the heap. If you start with a heap of sand and you take one grain away, you're still left with a heap. But if you keep repeating the process, you wind up saying that a single grain of sand is a heap all by itself. That's what comes of assuming that if a distinction isn't clear-cut, it can't be drawn at all. The Supreme Court justices love to torment attorneys with slippery slope examples in an effort to get them to clarify their positions. It's what gives the court transcripts the air of absurdist theater. But the technique is more disconcerting when it moves from the hypothetical to assertions of fact, the way it did in Justice Scalia's dissent in the Texas case. According to Scalia, once you start throwing out laws that reflect the moral choices of the majority, you undermine the basis for state laws against bigamy, same-sex marriage, adult incest, prostitution, masturbation, adultery, and bestiality, among others. I have the feeling that Scalia had a great time drawing up that list, but it's hard to believe he really buys the logic, that the law can't distinguish between masturbation and bestiality beyond saying that many people disapprove of both of them. At least it's hard to see Scalia voting to overturn some state anti-bestiality statute on the grounds that the Texas sodomy decision leaves him no choice. But the real problem with slippery slope arguments isn't their logic, it's the rhetorical games people play with them. They have a way of turning every decision into an unprecedented step into the void. In theory, after all, you could use Scalia's logic to run the metaphor uphill. You could just as easily say that refusing to overturn the Texas statute would open the way to laws restricting nose rings, public dancing, or other things that voters might find morally unacceptable. But nobody ever brings up the slippery slope to argue for a change in law or policy. It's always an argument for maintaining the status quo. The English legal scholar Glanville Williams once called the slippery slope the trump card of the traditionalist, because no proposal for reform is immune to it. That comes with a metaphor of describing a decision as stepping off the edge of a slope. But law and policy decisions are rarely that dramatic. It's more like carving our way along a hillside, making small adjustments as we go. Or to mix the metaphor, we all agree that we want to keep the camel's nose and haunches inside the tent and leave his nether parts out in the desert. The question always comes down to where we want to put the hump.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University's Center for the Study of Language and Information and the author of The Way We Talk Now.